You're listening to the Prepared Homestead Podcast, equipping you to build a self-sufficient homestead in uncertain times.
We're your hosts, Sean and Monica Mitzel, coming to you from Sovereign Sunrise Permafarm in the mountains of northern Idaho. We're glad you're with us.
Okay, so Cody, it is a real pleasure to have you on as Wrangler Star. So that, again, as I was telling you before we jumped on here, your channel was actually instrumental in my training as we got ready to come out and do some homesteading. I want to start by having you tell us a little bit about this idea of being a modern homesteader. And that term is kind of wide open. That term means different things to different people. And I don't mean that in a relativistic sense. I just mean that in it's not very well defined. So once again, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your time. And could you start by telling us the answer to that question from your perspective?
Yeah, for our perspective, a modern homesteader is doing what you can with what you have where you're at. Homesteading has become really popular. The whole prepping movement, or those people that didn't want to be associated with that, have kind of gravitated over to the homesteading side of it. And there's a lot of elitism. Some folks think that unless you have 40-plus acres and you're doing livestock and you have all these things that you're not a real homesteader, and I reject that. We have folks that are what I would consider to be modern homesteaders that are doing it on the city lot with garden boxes and raising their own chickens and doing what they can with what they have. It's not ideal. It's not what their ultimate goal is, but there's no reason you can't be homesteading wherever you're at with what you have.
Absolutely. I think that's really great because that's an important aspect for people to understand that if you can't move out to all of that acreage right away, there's still things that you can do where you're at.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter if all you got is a small, tiny postage stamp backyard. You can do something.
Matter of fact, in Okinawa, we did that. We started garden boxes because that's all we could do. So that's great. So then tell me, what prompted you to make this major life change? What happened, or was there a particular moment that sort of inspired you guys to move out and do? Because this is a huge change from your city life to a homesteading life.
It was a huge change, and we didn't, when we met, my wife and I, she was working a big corporate job in the city of Portland. I had started up an internet business, and we were working, at least 80 hours a week.
Yeah.
We purchased, of course, like every family does, our first home, and we were remodeling that at the same time, and it was a crazy lifestyle. We would get up 5 o'clock in the morning. We would eat on the way to work. I would take her to work. We ate out 3 meals a day. We came home exhausted to a cold home. And we just realized after a while, like, this is not the way we want to live. And my wife became pregnant on her honeymoon. And having a son, having our first child, really opened our eyes to the environment that we were in. The things that really as young professionals and couples, we begin to see them differently. Like, you know, we really don't want to raise kids in this environment. So we knew that something was wrong. It needed to change, that if we continued down that road, it would probably end in divorce like so many families do. Mm-hmm. We came across a family that had a similar story. They were many years ahead of us. They got to the point where they were so frazzled, they were so stressed out that they knew that they were about to get a divorce. So they drastically changed their lifestyle. They sold their business. They sold their home, everything that they had, and they bought a remote property in northern Montana and went off-grid. And we happened to read their book and their story, meet them, and spend some time with them, and that's what got us going the direction that we are.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. And it's really neat that how God brings people into our lives that lead us to where he plans us to go. That's really neat. So then tell me, you were talking about how busy your life was and how stressed. So how is your life different now because of this change?
Well, it's different now that we are all together. And what my wife always says is, you know, when we ask this question is, you know, we like each other. My wife and her best friends, and we like to be together. We don't want to be separated. It is important that each person has their own space, and we make an effort to, I have my wood shop that I can go to, but ultimately, we want to come back together. We enjoy 3 meals a day. We rarely leave unless we need to. We try to be careful and not to schedule too much, but we can do what we want. We can spend time together. We can sit down at the table and eat. And that, the time, we choose, in life we choose two things. Either we choose time or money. That's basically what it comes down to. There's very few people that can have both.
Right.
And that's the decision that we made. We wanted time more than we wanted money.
That's excellent, and we can definitely resonate with that. As someone who spent 24 years in the Marine Corps and deploying, that's one of the greatest things we have now is we get to spend time together, although it's very challenging as well. It's a whole new thing, that's for sure, with its own challenges. But and then you mentioned it indirectly, but the freedom involved, and that's really, really awesome to hear. Now, we on our homestead, we approach things from a distinctly Christian worldview, and it's one of the things we really appreciate about you guys. You don't hide your faith. You don't dance around it. You're not ashamed of the gospel, and we really appreciate that. So how has your faith impacted your current lifestyle?
Well, it's the most important thing. You know, I mean, I heard a story I was talking to years ago, a couple that fight all the time, and they were devout Christians, and they had, I don't know, they must have had a half a dozen Bible studies going on at any given time. And they told me the story about how they would be fighting like cats and dogs in the car on the way to the Bible study.
Oh, no.
And then in the driveway, walking up to the front door, put on their Christian face, and then go in and try to teach the gospel. You know, and God can't really work with people like that. You need to have, I guess to use a military metaphor, you need to have a strong base camp. You need to have a place where you can start your campaign and where a safe place where you can come and resupply and have everything that you need to go out and to commit and continue to meet these missions and these objectives. And so having the homestead to us is a sanctuary in this sinful, difficult world that everything around us is trying to pry the family apart, to separate and to break down families, because the devil knows that the family is the foundation of this country, and it's the foundation of Christianity. And anything that he can do by separating the husband and wife, because once you're separated, you're open to temptations that you wouldn't normally have if you were together. I remember traveling; I would be on business trips before I was married. Hotels, and you have men and women together in an environment that brings temptations that for a lot of people are hard to resist. But having my wife with me and making that pact together, we will always travel together, that we're always there, we insulate ourselves from those things. So, I'm sorry, I'm ranting and I forgot what your question.
That's okay. You're doing great. How has your faith impacted your current lifestyle? And you're obviously giving us a really good look into that, which is awesome, and telling us a little bit about how, you know, this corrupt culture and how you're kind of insulating yourself from it. At the same time, you're still in it. You're just not of it.
Yeah, and you're building a strong familial foundation and a strong marriage, which then is being seen by the world and is also being seen by your son, which is extremely important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, there are so many things that we really love about homesteading. There's obviously a lot more things we're still trying to learn, but I really appreciate some of the insights that you've given us.
So then tell us, Cody, what are some of the things that you really love about homesteading?
Well, you know, one thing that was really important for us, we realized off the bat, is that you need to, if you're not in debt, if you don't have car payments and a bunch of these things hanging overhead, it gives you a lot of a lot more freedom. And so the freedom aspect of it, I think, is my favorite thing.
Mm.
You guys know as well as we do that there's never a shortage of things that need done on the homestead. We work harder now than we ever have anywhere else. But there's a big difference. The difference is we're doing what we want to do. We can literally wake up. Of course, there are things that need being done. But for the most part, we can decide, what do we want to do today? Do we want to work out in the forest? Do we want to work in the garden? Do we want to work in the wood shop? Having the ability to make your own decision and to do what you want to do is without price.
Absolutely.
And I would imagine that right now one of your priorities is the renovation in your home.
Yeah, it seems pretty cold over there, Cody.
Yeah.
I can tell you a funny story with that. So we've been here for almost 4 years, and the house has been in pretty rough condition. It was foreclosure when we bought it, and my wife has been very patient. But one thing she's wanted from the beginning was to upgrade her kitchen, because she spends so much time in there, you know, preparing three meals a day. And then she sees me, you know, doing my wood shop and my blacksmithing and all these things. Finally, it just got to the point where she went out and bought all the kitchen cabinets and brought them home and said, it's time for the kitchen remodel.
That's awesome.
That's
where we're at.
That is
great. Way to go, Mrs. Wrangler Star.
Yes. Okay, so you told us some of the things you really like about it, and I couldn't agree more. We really love the freedom involved with it, at least to a degree. Of course, we, you know, we're all constrained by various things, but we do love that aspect. What are some of the biggest challenges you face?
Biggest challenges? You know, I guess for me, I like to see things completed. I like things to be just right. I like my office, my wood shop, and things to be just right. With a property of this size, when I first walked it and looked at it, the amount of things that needed done and undoing, it was just astronomical. Mm-hmm. And it depressed me, because I thought, grief, there's no way I'm ever going to get just the forest alone, just dealing with that would be a work of a lifetime. And God really spoke to me and helped me to see what it is. It's just, you know, it's not my job to finish everything and to get everything perfect. The joy and the lessons are in the work. And yeah, if I can leave it 10% better, 1% better than I did when I found it for my children, then I've done something good here. I've done something worth doing. And that was a real release to me, to be able to go out and to, instead of looking at this huge thing that needed to be done, but to enjoy the little bit that I could do today.
Awesome. Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah, because nothing will ever be completely done.
Right.
On a homestead, and especially if you've got a lot of land. It's just, it's...
It does seem overwhelming, and we tend to, again, I start in close, and we're working our way out, and, you know, that's not a perfect methodology, but that's how we're working. So, we're working in the tightest 5 acres, and, you know, we'll hopefully get out to do some more thinning and pruning
yeah,
in the forest.
Further out.
I think that is a perfect path. I think that's the way you do it. I remember walking down to the edge of it, and I drew a line in the sand in the dirt there with my boot, and I measured a 10 by 10 square. It was so dense, and there was so much brush and so many things that need doing, that I said, today I'm going to clear 10 feet by 10 feet. And that's where it started. And that, when I cleared that, I had a sense of satisfaction that it was just wonderful.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah, that's
very
great.
Nice.
Okay, so now let's just transition a little. How is homesteading impacted? I know that Mrs. Wrangler Star is the main educator, but how has it impacted or changed the education of your son?
Well, we've always homeschooled, and we don't worry about it too much. We look at homeschooling isn't about just sitting at a desk and doing math for an hour and doing history for an hour, but it's in everything that we do. So if we decide to, we don't want to be tied down by it. We don't want it dictating what it is that we can do. If we want to go cross-country skiing for the day, or we want to go backpacking, or if we want to go into town, we try to incorporate whatever we're doing with the homeschooling. Homeschooling to us is my son Jack working with me, taking drywall screws out and reading tape measure, and all of these things can be homeschooling. So we don't sweat it too bad and just try to make everything a learning opportunity. Walking in the forest, I'm always quizzing him about what type of tree species here, what can you eat here, how to start a fire. Homeschooling is in everything that we do.
Okay, so then I'm gonna get a little more specific here. Has it changed since you moved from your city life?
Well, it's, you know,
or
Jack
what
was,
or was he? Have you always homeschooled in at the homestead?
Yeah, we only started homeschooling seriously here. He was so little when we moved out that it wasn't something that we did when we lived in the town.
Okay. Yeah, because for us, I mean, over the years, you know, being in the military, our kids have gotten a lot of different experiences. We homeschool exactly like what you're talking about, because everywhere we'd go, there's new opportunities for learning, learning new cultures and a whole history around wherever we were. And so it was really an opportunity for us to get the kids to know that area. And so homesteading has been a natural transition for us to go, okay, now we get more practical skills and you get to learn some things that we weren't able to expose you to necessarily in our 24 years in the Marine Corps. And so it's been really neat for us to see not only character growth, but also skill growth in our children.
Absolutely. I'd say it's been a great joy to see that I can take my kids out in the forest and they can identify, you know, the different kinds of pines and cedars and hemlock and birch and all this. And it's just a wonderful thing because we didn't have those skills before.
No.
So that's been really great, even for us yeah. too. I mean, we're getting an education.
Yeah,
big
and
time.
It's really neat to talk to other homeschoolers who are educating their children that way,
yeah.
in a way that teaches them that life is learning. It's not sitting down at a desk and learning from, you know, 9 to 3. That's life. Life
right?
is about learning.
Right. We want to get our kids and get them to the point of being able to learn on their own. I mean, that's the whole goal. Education doesn't stop. Learning doesn't stop. And it's not all in a book.
Right.
Hey, so...
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I have a friend who worked at hiring for one of the top defense manufacturers in the country. And he was talking about how difficult a time they're having finding young people that have the ability to critically think.
Yeah.
They have been taking kids top of the class out of MIT and out of these top Ivy League schools, and yet they test really well and they have really good book smarts. But when it comes down to figuring a solution to a problem that isn't with the parents or obvious, they don't have the ability. He said what they're finding out is that kids were raised with parents that had them in the shop fixing lawnmowers, making them come up with solutions. Homesteading is so good about that because you're so far from the hardware store or Home
yep.
Depot or Napa that when your snowblower breaks or your rototiller breaks or something breaks down, you just don't. It's not an option to run down and get the part. So you're always trying to figure out ways. You're always adapting and using a creative way to problem solve and to solve solutions with what you have. And he said that they find that those kids that were raised in that environment have an incredible ability not only to critically think but to solve problems.
Absolutely.
That's excellent. Well, hey, I'm gonna get a little specific with you. I'm really curious about a couple things. And the next question for you is this. So in your book you talk about being zone 3, and we're right here on the edge between 5 and 6. And I thought we had challenges, but I'm curious about your challenges in zone 3 as far as growing food. And I know that there's every property has its own little microclimates. We've got warmer and colder areas on our property, but for you in particular, being zone 3 and quite cold, so what are some of the unique challenges of growing food in that cold climate? And what have you done to kind of overcome that?
Well, yeah, the challenges are obvious that our frost will be so late and our growing season is too short. What we found originally was we came from the valley in the Pacific, or down in Portland, the Willamette Valley, which is some of the best growing soil and climate in the entire world, where you can just grow anything. So up
yeah.
here, where what's the state? And we brought a lot of those ideas with us, and we planted things. You know, we planted corn, for example, and it just wasn't enough growing season. We never got any corn. And so rather than trying to reinvent the wheel, we started to meet with our neighbors and people that have lived up here for generations. And when I go down the road and I see my neighbors harvesting corn, I'm like, well, he knows something that I don't know, and I go and talk to him. And he tells me, well, I've got this variety, or I plant in tires, or I do this type of thing. And so we started talking to neighbors that were really doing well, whether it be apples and pears, and we're copying those type of varieties that they're using. We started learning how to graft and taking scions from local trees here that are native that do really well. And so rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and just get frustrated with it, we just went around to see what will this area support, what's doing well, what are our neighbors doing, and just went and asked them for help and just copied what they've done.
Excellent. Yeah, those are some great answers there. You're talking about local wisdom. You're talking about cultivars that are adapted to the area. And even in permaculture, one of the main things is understand the climate that you're in and what actually grows there. You know, you start there, just like you said. So that's awesome. Now, you guys do have a greenhouse. Do you use that for starts? Or?
Yeah, we have a greenhouse that we use for starts. But what we really have been doing starting, we have a nice a couple banks of windows on the south side of the house, and we built some shelves that fit into these large windows, and my wife starts most of her seeds in right in that window.
Excellent. Is there a cold climate greenhouse in your future? Like that?
There is. We've got several neighbors that have put large cold frames up. We've helped them install them, and several of them are harvesting different things and selling them commercially. So we're pretty excited about looking into that and getting a bigger greenhouse than we have now.
Awesome. Right. Same with us. We have a greenhouse that we want to attach to the house on the south side, insulate it and everything, make it a basically a four-season greenhouse in the future. We have a few more projects in front of that.
It's got a few things to do around here.
Okay.
The thing is, my wife is, her family's from Sweden, and we were just reading an article in a Swedish paper of a family that built a really big greenhouse right over top of their house.
Wow.
It was fascinating to see how they essentially don't have to heat their home anymore. And they live in the north in Sweden, which is the climate really for what we have here. And they're essentially living in a Mediterranean climate in northern Sweden.
Wow. That is incredible.
That's intriguing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're missing out in here in, you know, North America. We tend to build based on cheap energy rather than smart design. Well, hey, the next question I have for you. In fact, Monica and I are in the Master Forest Stewards Program here in Idaho. Because we obviously have a family forest, we love spending time in God's creation, and we want to be wise stewards of the land. And you're obviously very skilled in this area. What advice would you give people who also want to become a wise steward over their forest land? And by the way, this is a little bit of a selfish question because we want your advice for us.
Well, you know, for me, I'm not an expert on this, but it's you're asking if I could, what's my favorite thing to do, and my favorite thing to do is to be out there with my chainsaw and my silky saws and working in the forest. I love it out there. My wife says that she likes to run, and she speaks to God the clearest when she's running. That I cannot understand, but I can understand speaking to him when I'm out in the forest.
Okay.
So I have a real passion for that, but I didn't have a lot of knowledge when we started. Like you said, we have a state recognized stewardship forest, and what that means is that we have state foresters and experts, and many states have these programs. Will come out with you and walk your land, and that was one of the most beneficial things that I could do, because I had the forester come out, and several times we would walk the land. They pointed out to me which trees are native, which trees and plants and bushes are invasive, and it got me started on the right path. Wildland fire, that might be a consideration for you as well. So it's a real balancing act between what you'll find government agencies that are only concerned about fire, and if you just take their opinion, they'll have you just take way too many trees out, in my opinion. Basically make your forest look like a park. Mm. And that's nice to hang out in, and it's a beautiful thing to kind of walk through with your family, but it's not necessarily a healthy forest. So on the other side, you'll have people that will tell you from these agencies what constitutes a healthy forest, but with no mind to wildland fire and fire prevention. So we've had to really take both of these opinions and kind of weigh them, and then take a little from both, and then make the decision what we wanted and what we determined was best for us.
Oh, excellent. What are some of the main tree species on your property?
We have a mix of Doug fir is the primary. We're in a really special zone. It's called a transitional forest. When you think of the Pacific Northwest, you think of Seattle and Portland, how rainy it is. We're just east of the Cascades, so we get a little bit of a slop over that coastal rain and that weather, but we get 300 days of sunshine a year.
Wow, okay.
If you go to the east of here, it just turns into just high desert. Mm-hmm. There's no conifers or anything, so it's about a five-mile strip of just this beautiful climate. We have that nice mix of pines, which you typically find in drier climates, Doug firs. We have cedars do really well here, just beautiful trees here.
Excellent. Sounds like we have a similar species composition. Like I said, we have three kinds of pine, and we have cedar and hemlock and birch, Doug fir, grand fir, actually a lot of Doug fir, grand fir. And up here in the panhandle, a lot of our pest and disease tend to, well, Doug fir and grand fir tend to be susceptible to those, so that we we try and keep this diverse mix, like you, but we're trying to maintain more things like larch and
white pine.
And, of course, we love our cedars too. I just love it. Love it. But yeah,
absolutely. And I think, I think the more I study and research this, a lot of the problems that we have, with these diseases, especially for our conifers, is from these massive monocultures.
Yep.
It was never God's plan to have an entire stand of Doug firs or white firs,
yep,
or ponderosas. And that's what that's what we're surrounded with. The timber companies, they are going to plant the most profitable tree, which is going to be Doug firs. So what you have is you have these bugs come in that, and we're finding out now that there's nothing to repel them. The trees actually help one another out. When you have a good, healthy forest with mixed conifers and you have broad leaves and you have the native plants, you have a forest the way God designed it to be, they actually, one tree will repel a particular beetle or a bug that will affect another. And they lean upon one another, and they rely upon one another, and we've stripped all of that away, and then we wonder why our forests are having so many problems.
Right.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's the same thing with agriculture. We set the table for pests and disease to come in and with no competition. So yeah, that's great advice. So one of the things that we're doing here is we balance, just like you said, we're not trying to park out anything, but we do need to work on thinning, because we have like heavy, thick stands of grand fir and Doug fir, and we want to thin those out so as not to set the table, but we're really working hard to keeping a good species mix.
Yeah, so we can let the healthy ones actually be healthier.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about this a little bit, but you guys mentioned in your book that your homestead is always in progress, and I would agree. I don't, especially if we talked about it, how, you'd like to be accomplished, like done, but you realize that that's just never going to happen. So what are your hopes and aspirations? What are some things that you're hoping for your homestead in the future?
What I would like to do is, when I look around here, I never thought that I would assume the role of a teacher, or that would appeal to me. And I've had that opportunity with the YouTube channel to kind of enjoy that and to taste what that's like. We have these big buildings and outbuildings and barns, many of them are not being used. I would really like to turn this into a place where people could come and they could teach horticulture, or we could teach canning, or we could teach timber framing or proper stewardship, forestry. That's something that would be my long-term goal that I would like to do on the homestead.
Awesome. That's really great. And it sounds like some similar things of what we're trying to do here. And you have been a teacher, whether you meant to or not, that's for sure. Anything else? I mean, you want to, how about particularly, do you have any, are you going to expand your orchard? Are you going to, you mentioned the cold climate greenhouse, things like that. Anything else in the horizon?
Yeah, we're working on, in the remodel, I'm already doing the wiring and the plumbing so I can incorporate being completely independent, off-grid. We're not off-grid now, but when I do, as I'm working with electrical panel now, it's always with an eye to for the future solar array and for the hot water system, wood-fired hot water system, and those type of things where we can be completely independent. Don't worry about if you're homesteading and you're not there yet. It's the way it goes. Unless you want to go into $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt to have someone come out and put these systems in, then I wouldn't recommend doing that. Get into a place. It's all about location. Water is the number one thing. Always be improving your water. It's something I'm always working on, and irrigation, and everything with the mind of being completely self-sufficient and independent. And, I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the future? And I look at this homestead, if times really get trouble, whether it's our country is attacked or there is a massive earthquake or man-made or natural disaster, that this would be a refuge for my family. I don't want to get caught flat-footed. And when the power line is no longer connected to my house or is no longer an option for me, I don't want to be high and dry. So everything that I do, whether it be restoring the crosscut saws or teaching myself how to use those old tools that our my great grandparents used, it's not because I think that they're better than what we have, because I would not want to have to give up my chainsaw for a cross cut saw.
Absolutely.
However, if I had to, I can do it.
Right.
Right.
When the time comes when you need to cut 10 cords of firewood and you can't use your chainsaw and you haven't taken the steps to learn how to use a cross cut saw or own one or sharpen one or maintaining, that time's too late. It's not going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah, now absolutely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, sorry, now is the time to get those tools and to get those skills. And you don't have to be an expert at it, but you have to at least be proficient and understand that, yes, it will be a lot of work, but if my wife and I, if we had to do it, we could go out and we could cut 10 cords of firewood and heat our home with this saw, and I could sharpen it if I had to.
Excellent. Now, that's really, really wise words. And we always talk about, we joke that if everything went bad and we were down to our last drop of gas, it would go through the chainsaw.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You talk about everything going bad. When we made the decision to do this years ago, our family, they were really concerned. I thought that they were going to hold an intervention. I couldn't believe that we would give up such a promising career and this beautiful home that we had built and all of these things to move out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they were really concerned for us. They thought we were absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Fast forward to now, and this started 3 or 4 years ago, those same friends and family members are now coming out, and they're saying things like, not that you guys are crazy for moving out here, but would it be okay if we kept a few things out here, or,
yeah,
or we kept food, or would it be possible for us to build a small cabin if things got bad or trouble? You know, it's, people are waking up to this, and these are hardcore urbanites. And the attitude is changing, and times are changing, and the future of our country is so uncertain that people are waking up to this and starting to see that there may be a real threat.
Absolutely. Yeah. We couldn't agree with you more. And you said you hit one thing there at the very end. Times are uncertain, and they certainly are.
Yeah.
One of the things that you had mentioned was talking about basically making a resilient homestead in case if whether times are good or bad, it's still going to be very worthwhile. But resiliency is important. And in fact, you've been talking about wildland fire. Just this last summer, we had a fire. We had all those fires happening around us. One cropped up less than a half mile from the property, and Monica and I were actually gone. And the kids had 10 minutes to leave with whatever, you know, they had. And unfortunately, we have talked about these types of things, about being prepared, et cetera. And that's one example on that end. On the other hand, we just had that major windstorm, which I'm sure you felt some of that. And we lost power and all that. And we work hard at building resilient systems. And you mentioned water, and we couldn't agree more. Water is crucial. And we lost power. And so, of course, you know, our well is on a submersible pump, and we have a generator. And guess what? The generator wouldn't run the well pump because of stray voltage, which a few days later, the well pump went bad. But we had a hand pump on our well, and we have water storage. And normally we do rainwater collection. That's seasonally, though. But we have ponds and streams, etc. So we had built in some redundancies in our systems for just that purpose. So even though it wasn't as fun and we didn't have running water, we had plenty of water. So that it's just very important things that you talked about.
Water is the most important thing. I mean, absolutely. I mean, when you look at the fundamentals of survival, people think, well, the first thing I need to do is to get something to eat, you know, but that's not the case.
Nope.
I mean, the first thing you need to protect yourself from is exposure.
Yes.
So living in an environment, choosing a homestead, we spent years and years and looked at hundreds, if not a thousand properties, and there was a couple things that were really important. Water was in the very, very top. We didn't, just because it has a well doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to solve your problems, because in this part of the country, we can have wells that are 800 feet deep. Without that three-phase power, that 240 power, which is very hard to duplicate, you're not lifting that water out of there.
Absolutely.
And you're not going to put a bucket and a rope and a four-inch well. So to have some property, whether it be a spring or ponds or rainwater collections or cisterns like they did in the old days, is absolutely fundamental.
Yes, and definitely not doing a bucket through a six-inch casing.
Not going to happen. And exposure, when we talk about exposure, okay, so how are you going to keep your family warm? In that me means firewood and an abundant supply of it. How much firewood do you need? You know, how big of a property? How, if you cut 10 cords of wood a year, how big of a piece of property and how much timber do you need to have for that to be a continuous, to be able to sustain itself?
Right.
Absolutely.
So I don't have the answer for that. It's different because it depends on species and BTUs and all that. And how far do you have to go to get it? What if you can't hook up the back of your truck a winch or use your tractor to pull it up to the house? You know, all of those things need to be considered.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually enjoyed that part of the book where it basically it talks about how you kind of cycle through those different aspects of basic survival. I talk with my kids all the time about we go through the rules of three, which you're probably familiar with because you're really talking about it. You know, 3 hours with exposure to extreme weather, 3 days without 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food, etc. And you can cycle through those, and that can help you along in determining your priorities. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, if it comes down to the point where a family's got to be self-sufficient, I mean, you really don't need that much to live. Once we strip away all of the things that we think that we need to live, we need to be able to heat our house, we need to heat our home or whatever we're living in, we need to be able to have clean drinking water and a source of food.
Yep.
And when my grandparents moved over, when they were homesteaders in Oklahoma, they acquired their land from the Oklahoma land rush. During the Dust Bowl, they weren't able to farm anymore. They packed up everything they had, just like the Grapes of Wrath, and they moved to Sun Valley, Idaho, and the family lived in wall tents for 3 years. Little kids, the women, everyone in there, while the men went out and cut firewood and logs for a living.
Wow.
My great-grandfather turned his Model A Ford into a sawmill, and that's how they made a living. And that family lived in those wall tents for 3 years in Sun Valley, and that's a harsh climate.
Yeah,
that is.
Wow. Yeah, that's
impressive.
That's hard living right there.
That is.
But you're exactly right. You're exactly right.
You don't really need that much. So it's just important to have those things in perspective. If the power didn't come, if we didn't have gasoline, you know what? Could we get water? Yes, check that off. Can we heat our home? Yes, check that off. And can we eat? Can we food? Do we live in an area? Have we taken the steps? Do we have the knowledge to be able to hunt and process game? You know, all of those things are always on my mind.
Excellent. Yeah. Those are great. Those are great themes. You know, one of actually talking about themes, one of the main themes from your book is really talking about property and homestead property. And I know that it's extremely difficult to distill it down to a couple of key points, but if you had to, for people as they search for property, what would you tell them? What would you give them as a couple of key points in searching for homestead property?
Oh, it's so tough.
I know.
First off, I think the most important thing is to be in a place that you enjoy being. We had to make, my wife and I both had to make compromises with the place that we're at now. I wanted to go North Montana and really go hardcore at the Canadian border and off-grid and as rough and tough as you could possibly make it. That was fine for me, but I don't need to have interaction with a lot of people. I enjoy just having my family around, and I'm content with that. My wife, on the other hand, is not that way. She's very social. She has a group of ladies that they meet once a month, and they have for 17 years, and she wanted, it was important for her to have access to that. I could have bullied her, and I could have forced, you know, dug in my feet and forced the issue and took her up there, but where would we have been in 3 or 4 years?
Right.
She would have been miserable. I would have been miserable. There would have been resentment. It would have been a tremendous mistake, and so it was really important for us to make that compromise, so we wrote a list. You know, what is it that's important to you? And it was important for her not to live further than an hour and a half from friends and family. It was important for me to be in a place where I didn't see any other people. And so making that compromise and making sure that just don't go out and buy a piece of land in the middle of nowhere and set up a tent and start homesteading, you got to consider the needs of your family, and you got to be realistic what your abilities are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Those are great.
Well, as a matter of fact, I've talked to quite a few people over even the many years when we've talked about homesteading and what we're going to do after we got out of the Marine Corps. And the guys are usually more motivated toward that. And a lot of women are like, no way, Jose. And our advice to them is, okay, wait until she's ready. Because if you try and force it, It's never going to work. You'll either end up divorced or you'll end up back in the city.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to be much worse than the latter.
Oh, yeah. It really will.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I do consulting, I do property analysis and design, basically using permaculture. So I look at energy, waste, water, food production, access, structures, water, you know, all those kinds of things, and kind of help people to become more self-sufficient. One of the mistakes I see often is that people will buy, they'll get a property that's way too far out and they're just not happy.
Yeah, they have
no access, there's not very good water. They're making some fundamental errors. And it's just, it seems to be a common mistake. They get motivated and excited and they just go for it without really thinking through it. So I did appreciate that part of the book. You really, you guys asked a lot of questions that hopefully people will consider very carefully.
Yeah.
It's so important to be honest with yourself. I mean, how are you going to make a living? How are you going to pay for that? I think we have a chapter in the book on that.
Yeah.
And, there's either two choices. Either you're going to do something on the homestead, an online business or something like that, or you're going to have an off-homestead job.
Right.
And so if you do have an off-homestead job, you've got to consider what is a realistic commute.
Yes,
sure. That needs to be made. With that being said, though, I mean, there people oftentimes complain about, you know, the American dream is dead and the opportunities are not there. I absolutely disagree with the access to the internet and with satellite internet, these things, you can start a business. You can. There's so many ways to make money that haven't even been considered yet. We have so many interesting stories out here because there's a lot of people in the same boat as us. We live in a community that is very, very pro-homeschooling. It's kind of the epicenter of the homeschooling movement is kind of started in this area, and people are coming up with really creative ways to be able to make money and to pay for this.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, if you're not in debt, you don't have car payments, Mrs. W and I, we buy our clothes, by and large, either on super sales or at the secondhand store.
Mm-hmm.
We buy, I drive a car, two of my cars have over 250,000 miles, and I keep them going. But I own them, and it doesn't cost me anything to keep these things. And so when you start doing this and cutting your life down and start to grow in some of your own food, and you don't have a water bill anymore, and you don't have an oil or electrical bill for heating your home, you really don't need to make that much money.
Right. So
there's folks out here, I'll just give you a couple examples of interesting businesses. There's a guy out here that started a business. He has about 14 employees now, and he put up owl houses all over in the forest, and he collects owl pellets and sells them to public schools.
Cool.
And he's things all over the world. That's one example. There's another guy that there's such a demand for people for things that are handmade of really high quality. There's a guitar manufacturer out here. There's a guy that makes hand-laid wooden dories. There's all sorts of really interesting small businesses that are internet-based and that allow people to work from home and do what they want to do and to not leave. And you need to be thinking in that direction when you make this decision.
Yeah, one of the things that we're very entrepreneurial, and we have a couple of different small businesses, and we actually were sitting down the other day, and we figured out that over the last couple of years, mm-hmm. we've come up with 11 different sources of income. Now, a lot of those were hardly anything at all, but it doesn't matter because they're just going through ideas and trying to implement them, and some of them will fall flat on their face, and some of them will likely do very well. About 11 different sources of income, and that's all from either from our land or just us creating it.
Yeah.
Or whether it's processing animals for people, or to selling eggs, to doing consulting for others. But one of the things that we're really exploring right now is some non-timber forest products. So all the anything from mushrooms, cultivating mushrooms, to even this time of year, people love cedar boughs, that kind of thing. It's amazing. I look at the cedars all around here, and then we go to Costco and we see people buying all these cedar boughs.
I know.
It's like, really?
$20. Like, oh my word, we could have just brought ours from the backyard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And, one thing that I want to be sure and get across, I really believe this because is that it's really easy to say that I'm going to do this, and I'm going to make all of this happen, and it's all down to me. But what I learned, I made that mistake in the first property that we bought, is not partnering with God on this. I really believe with all my heart that if you are sincere as a family, if you sincerely want to move out for the right reasons, not to come out and hide from someone, not to come out and boost your pride about what an independent, self-sufficient family you are, but to put yourself in an environment that's more conducive to having a better relationship, a better walk with Christ, that he will provide opportunities for you to make a living in ways that you hadn't even thought of. That's really important to make sure that you partner with God when you make this decision as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
totally
absolutely.
Agree. Okay, so you've told us that you're kind of a private person.
You don't want to see people, is what you said.
On your property. okay. So then this is a good question. How are you dealing then with all of the attention and fame that's come along with your Wrangler Star YouTube channel and now the book?
Oh, yeah. Same. You know, I keep it into perspective. My wife helps me to keep it into perspective.
keeping you
we
humble.
Like to remind each other that we're a couple of goofballs with $100 camera is where we started, and that's basically it. I got to be careful and remember that it is a trap. It's a real trap to receive 1,000 comments a day, emails from people, and all of them are just heaping praise on you. Mm. Oh, you know, your role model or idolize or all of these things, and you can. It would be easy to buy into all of that, and it's important to really make sure that we. Remember where we came from and that we are not anyone special and we're not different than anyone else who watches our channel. We just made the decision to do this and to upload these videos and to be really careful and don't start thinking. It's a real trap when people start, because you've done something or because now you're known as the axe guy or the forest guy or the chainsaw guy, to start thinking that you are, that you know everything there needs to be known. And that's just not the case. It's important for me, just to remember where we came from, to be humble, and to never consider ourselves above being able to learn something from someone else.
Great words, yes.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Sean and I were just talking about last night, the more you know, the more you don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, okay, so we're almost done. We're going to let you go here pretty quick. Now, what do you tell people? Because I'm sure you get this question a lot. They kind of come to you and they're going to say, well, how do I start? How do I get started? I want to do what you're doing. How do I get started?
Well, how you get started is get out of debt. That's the very first thing you need to do. If you've got credit cards, if you've got student loans, car payments, those things need to be gone. One thing that was just a belly blow for us, when we made the decision that we wanted to do this, I never really paid attention to our finances. Both of us were making six figures plus in income. So we traveled, we bought whatever we wanted. Even with those incomes, we were spending more money than we had. When we sat down and put all of our debt, student loans and all these things on paper, we were over $100,000 in debt. I had no idea. I couldn't believe it. There's no way out of this. There's no way we can get out, because I wanted to go now. The house was already for sale, and we were ready to go, but we couldn't do anything with this debt hanging over us. So a thing that really helped us, I think we talked about it in the book, is it Dave Ramsey?
Yeah.
Dave Ramsey got the Financial Peace University. We signed up for it. We found a church on Craigslist that was offering it. We went and took these classes. We read his book, and we got intense. All of everything that all we talked about, all we focused on was getting out of debt. I'm a spender. I didn't have any problem on buying $400 jeans and $500, $600 boots at all. It was just money was like water to me. I would just had with no thought to it. And so that desire and that rush that I got from that, I turned to what we called our debt poster. We put this big poster up on the wall, and we listed all of our debts just according to Dave's plan from the smallest to the largest. And I worked and worked and worked as hard as I could and sold and skimped and side jobs and everything that I could do to make as much money as possible. And I would bring that money home every night when I'd made some, and we would have a family event. We would write that number on there, and we'd watch that debt get smaller and smaller and smaller. and we'd put it right on our wall where we'd lay in bed before we went to sleep, and we would stare at it. We would talk about it, and our entire focus was to get out of debt because we knew that that was what shackled us. That wealth prevented us from doing everything we wanted to do. And we, with the family resolve to do this, and both of us working as hard as we could, we got that paid off in less than 2 years.
Awesome. The borrower is slave to the lender, that's for sure. Well, hey, you know, we're FPU graduates as well, and it started several years ago when we got a hold of Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover. So we know exactly what you're talking about, and it's so important. But what's encouraging is I run into people often who with similar stories, and they're working either they're out of debt or they're working hard to get out of debt. So yeah, That's encouraging.
Debt is absolutely the key. I hear it every day, time after time after time, after email asking me that same question. What do I do? I can't leave my job because I won't be able to pay my student loans and the new truck payment and the credit cards if I leave this thing. It is a form of soft slavery, and if you're bound by that, you don't have any options. I mean, that's why I ask people, consider this. If you didn't have a mortgage and you didn't have a car payment, and all you had to cover was food and taxes and maybe some medical insurance, what could you do? And the response is the same. Well, we could do anything.
Yeah. Right.
Right. No, you're exactly right. That's awesome. Well, hey, Cody, I think we're going to wrap it up here. Again, we really appreciate you taking the time out, talk to us, giving us some really good things to talk about here, good points. I'm hoping to run into you someday, maybe at an event somewhere. I'd love to get a chance to shake your hand and say hello in person someday.
Well, thank you. I would too.
How can people? Obviously, they can go to your YouTube channel, and that's where a lot of people are. But how can they get a hold of your book? Because we really enjoyed it, and so how can they get a hold of it?
Yeah, you can just we set up our website. You can just go to wranglerstartbook.com, and that'll take you to our landing page, and you can purchase it there, or it's on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble, most major bookstores, most Christian bookstores. It's all over the place.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to ask you one more question. You don't have to divulge this if you want, but do you have any idea how many copies you've sold so far?
I can tell you that we just went into our second printing.
Awesome. Okay.
Congratulations.
Well, congratulations once again. We really enjoyed it and recommend people read it. In fact, your publicist has let us do – we're doing a giveaway on our page too. So people are clamoring and signing up, and they're saying, we want one. So that's pretty awesome.
They're fantastic people there, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yes. They're great. Yeah, really enjoy it. So once again, Cody, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to sit down and talk with you.
Thank you so much, John. I really enjoy talking with you.
Okay. And okay. Please tell your wife that we hope she feels better.
Yes.
I certainly will.
Okay. God bless you guys.
You too.
All right. Bye. Our verse for the day is Proverbs 22:7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is slave of the lender. And we want to send a special shout out to our longtime friend, Bruce, in Oklahoma. We appreciate you listening to our podcast. Thank you.